This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We are 10 days into the new year and election year, and already a wrench has been thrown into North Carolina politics. In a first-of-its-kind ruling, a three-judge panel of the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals said yesterday the state's congressional map was a partisan gerrymander. Previous maps have been struck down as racial gerrymanders. The judges said the map violated the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause by drawing the map to give Republicans an explicit advantage. The state has 13 congressional districts. 10 are Republican, 3 Democratic. Tuesday's ruling said lawmakers have no grounds to dispute that they intended to give the GOP a distinct leg up. In fact, one of the Republican architects of the congressional map, Representative David Lewis, made no bones about their intent when lawmakers were putting together the map in 2016.
I acknowledge freely that this would be a political gerrymander, which is not against the law. We want to make clear that we, to the extent, are going to use political data in drawing this map, it is to gain partisan advantage on the map. I propose that we draw the maps to give a partisan advantage to 10 Republicans and 3 Democrats, because I do not believe it's possible to draw a map with 11 Republicans and 2 Democrats.
Wow. Yeah. And that played a big role in yesterday's decision. North Carolina politics were already bound to be drawing national attention in this year's midterms. Democrats were targeting several Republican congressional districts, including one in the Charlotte area, as they hoped to ride an anti-Trump blue wave into a majority in the House and Senate. So what does the year ahead hold politically? We're going to spend the whole hour gazing into the crystal ball of three people who make it their business to know the answers to these questions. Dr. Michael, or at least to be, pretend to, Dr. Michael Bitzer, does that from the hallowed halls of Catawba College in Salisbury, where he is a professor of political science and a frequent host of this program. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
Dan McCorkle is a Democratic strategist. Both are in our studio in Charlotte. Dan, welcome back to you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Oops, let me turn your mic on. Now you can say thank you.
Oh, thank you.
And while Republican strategist Paul Shoemaker joins us from Raleigh, his clients include North Carolina Senator Richard Burr and 9th District Representative Robert Pittenger. Mr. Shoemaker, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, Mike.
So let's begin with something unanticipated till about 5:30 yesterday afternoon, and that is this big decision that came down yesterday when the panel of judges struck down our state's congressional election districts as unconstitutional partisan gerrymanders and gave lawmakers until, 10 days from now or 2 weeks to redraw the maps. This was a unanimous decision by a three-judge panel in the Fourth Circuit Federal Court, 2 Democratic appointees, 1 Republican appointees, and yet it was unanimous. And they said that lawmakers drew congressional maps that violated the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution because they specifically favored one political party over another, in this case the Republican Party. And it was quite clear from the cut that we just played that that is true.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he said when we played that cut, David Lewis said that this was perfectly legal.
It was.
Hasn't it been perfectly legal?
Yes.
So this is a new take on political gerrymandering.
We're entering new territory that I think a lot of us who study this are really going to be fascinated to see how it ultimately plays out. Previously, the U.S. Supreme Court has said partisan gerrymandering is perfectly legal and perfectly fine because we, the courts, do not want to get involved in this political question.
So why now?
Well, I think we're seeing the effects of our hyperpolarization going on in the country that, you know, when it comes to the point of stacking the deck so far in favor of one party over the other, that the courts are going to start to say there may be some constitutional issues.
But even though this was a unanimous decision, it's a 2-3 Democrat, 2-1 Democrat Republican balance here, and that's because I would guess previous Democratic presidents having more opportunity to appoint federal judges, and Obama's federal judges were never ruled on by the Congress, and now President Trump is going to appoint a lot of Republicans. Is that going to stop this wave, this change wave, so to speak?
It's hard to say. I think certainly Republican-leaning judges will look at this and say, you know, they really went above and beyond what the principles of constitutionalism is on this particular case. But, you know, there's going to be a lot of controversy. And I think the one key judge in all of this is going to be Anthony Kennedy on the U.S. Supreme Court. How does he rule in a case that's already there from Wisconsin?
Right.
How do they rule on the Maryland Congressional District case, which is Democrats dealing and having the power and basically subjecting Republicans to the same thing that Republicans did to Democrats in this state?
The judges yesterday said, and I think Judge Wynn wrote the opinion,
yes.
But he said, on its most fundamental level, partisan gerrymandering violates, quote, the core principle of Republican, small r, Republican government, that the voters should choose their representatives and not the other way around. And we've talked about this on this program before, that this is one of the problems and one of the demoralizing problems with voters not wanting to get out and vote because they sometimes don't have an alternative to vote for. It's only the Republican or only the Democrat running for office. And they have been put into districts where if you are of the opposing political point of view, it doesn't matter that you vote because you're going to lose.
I would agree with that. I would also contend that the districts are symptomatic of a deeper problem within ourselves, within our own neighborhoods, in that oftentimes we have sorted ourselves into like-minded communities. And for map makers, all they have to do is just basically look at a precinct or an area and can easily decipher which way this particular area goes and pack folks together or crack them, as they noted in the case.
So there is a law or there is a case pending before the Supreme Court that came out of Wisconsin.
Yes.
Is that case, along with the North Carolina case that was ruled on yesterday by the Fourth Circuit, are these the first challenges to this, to political partisan gerrymandering?
No. We have seen this in the past before, and in, I think, 2004, there was a case that came out of Pennsylvania that the court refused to take a stand on partisan gerrymandering, but it was a four-justice decision with Anthony Kennedy, who said, in this particular case, there's no legal standard by which we can say this is too much partisan gerrymandering or it's okay. What he issued was basically a challenge to all legal scholars and folks to say, come to me with a rationale or a judicial standard that we can apply to these kinds of cases, and then we'll talk about whether this is too much partisanship.
So the Fourth Circuit said that the way these districts in North Carolina have been drawn violates the free speech of the challengers by trying to weaken the voice of Democrats with whom they did not agree.
Right. And
this is that what's this
was one of the entries that Justice Kennedy laid out to say, you know, could this be a First Amendment issue? And that's when everybody kind of grabbed onto it and have been running with it.
So correct me if I'm wrong. The case before the Supreme Court right now out of Wisconsin deals with legislative districts partisan gerrymandered. Our case deals with federal districts, congressional districts.
Congressional districts.
So if the Supreme Court rules on the Wisconsin case in a similar fashion, will our state find itself redrawing yet again the legislative maps, or would a decision in this congressional case cause us to have to redraw the legislative maps again because we will have found that partisan gerrymandering is illegal?
I think both are going to have to be redrawn, congressional and the legislative districts, if the Supreme Court errs on the side of too much partisanship in gerrymandering.
So this is going to go to the Supreme Court. This is not going to be a fait accompli here with the Fourth Circuit.
We'll have to wait and see what happens with Wisconsin. They could put a stay on this decision in North Carolina pending the Wisconsin decision. If the Wisconsin decision comes down, then they would say to North Carolina, follow our lead in Wisconsin and revisit this and see if it's still good law.
And correct me if I'm wrong here, this is a Fourth Circuit court decision, so it only impacts
their
jurisdiction.
It's actually a three-judge panel in the Fourth Circuit. It doesn't have any – my understanding is it doesn't have any extension to the other states in the Fourth Circuit. This goes directly up to the U.S. Supreme Court from these three-judge panels.
So let me bring our Democrat and our Republican into this, and I'll start with Paul Shoemaker, the Republican, because this is, I guess, an attack on Republican ideals here in some ways. What's your reaction? What has been the party's reaction to this decision yesterday?
Well, as a longtime veteran of North Carolina politics, my reaction is this is not really anything new through the political process. Republicans made inroads in the 1980s when they were in the minorities through a lot of legislative redistricting challenges through the federal courts. Were very successful in busting up the system. In the 90s, this was taking place, very prevalent. In fact, Richard Burr, who was first elected in 1994, I think ran in three different congressional districts during the 90s. And in conversations with Republican lawmakers through this whole process, basically the Democrats have been well-schooled and well-versed in this process because of Republican successes in previous decades. So this is not new. This is going to be an ongoing fight. This is a fight. If you put five Republicans, five Democrats in a room together, they're not going to agree. Put 10 lawyers in the same room, they will not agree on anything either. It doesn't matter what their political affiliation is. So we're going to have this play out. It's going to continue to play out. It's not going to end this decade. It will continue to play out for a long time to come.
So what he just said, I believe, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, Paul Shoemaker, but he just said, Dan, that essentially we do it, the Democrats do it, we all do it. It's true.
It's not 1980 anymore. Okay, it's not 1950. It's not the good old days. Listen, the Republicans took control of the state legislature in 2010 on maps drawn by Democrats. Okay, yes, we did some light gerrymandering, but not this kind of extreme gerrymandering. I just want to know, this is the year 2018, what is wrong with fair competitive districts where the voters choose their reps based on local needs, not the party leadership?
Would you be saying that if Democrats were still in control and this ruling went against you?
Well, we never
Because
had.
You just got a stifled guffaw from Michael Pitcher.
Well, he's a learned man. I think it comes down to the Republicans and the state legislature. That's all I'm really talking about here. They're extremely unpopular. They're the most unpopular legislature probably in the country history of the world.
Not with Republicans.
Well, with Republicans, but that's about only 30% of the state population now. And they control how many seats? Like 10? Is it 10 to 3, Michael?
10 to 3.
So really, it's a majority Democratic state.
And that's because they couldn't do 11 to 2, is it?
That's right. That's exactly
they
right.
They couldn't find a way to do that.
This is a way that unpopular Republicans are clinging to power. The voter suppression did not work. We got early voting back. That's kind of righted itself. But the gerrymandering is all they have left because they're facing a demographic time bomb with women, minorities, immigrants. All these folks are voting Democratic. It's a time bomb. The Republicans are fighting it with everything they got.
So I only have a minute left.
Dan, you sound like a Republican from the 80s and the 90s.
back when y'all had like two seats or something in the Senate. I remember those days.
So Paul, yeah. I only have a minute left, but I want to get a clarification on something you said. This is going to go on and on and on for time immemorium. But if the Supreme Court decides, no, it's not, are you wrong?
No. But I mean, the Supreme Court has look at the whole case history of redistricting, not just from a North Carolina standpoint, from a national standpoint. There's going to be other arguments that are going to come up. Justice Kennedy, Dr. Bissler is exactly right. Justice Kennedy injected a new point into this discussion. My point is that the legal community, the lawyers, they're going to continue as if in 2021, there's going to be new legislative maps drawn. There's going to be new congressional maps drawn all across the country. You're going to see another round a redistricting lawsuit come out.
Paul Shoemaker is a Republican strategist. Dan McCorkle is a Democratic strategist. Dr. Michael Bitzer is caught in the middle. He's a professor of political science at Catawba College. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about the midterm elections. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and People's Bank, committed to turning vision into reality by listening, encouraging, and believing in possibilities. People's Bank, be exceptional. PeoplesBankNC.com, member FDIC. And Wilson Engineering Services, providing MEP, civil and environmental engineering services to the Carolinas. Wilson Engineering Services specializes in energy efficiency, renewable energy, and bioenergy systems. WilsonEngineeringServices.com. Well, a successful democracy depends on both a free press and an informed electorate, and our founding fathers thought this so important that they enshrined the concept in the First Amendment to the Constitution. But today, economic pressures and a lack of trust are threatening one of the cornerstones of our democracy. The dawn of fake news has further complicated things, and that's certainly the case nationally. Is the same true locally? We talk about that tomorrow at 9.
I'm Ray Suarez. Coming up on the next On Point, America has a teacher shortage that's expected to keep growing. Do the solutions shortchange American students? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
That conversation coming up at 10 following Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins here with Dr. Michael Bitzer, a political scientist from Catawba College, Dan McCorkle, a Democratic strategist here in Charlotte, Paul Shoemaker, a Republican strategist whose clients include Senator Richard Burr and Representative Robert Pittenger. The midterms are this year. It's hard to believe that President Trump will be in office 1 year exactly in 10 days from right now, and that means that this is a midterm election year, and Democrats have reason for hope, and so do Republicans. So we'll see which one has better reason to hope as we go through this hour. People on both sides will freely admit to the importance of these elections. Democrats want to win back at least part of the Congress as a means not only to regain some power but to rein in President Trump. Republicans view keeping control of both houses as paramount to being able to continue dismantling the Obama legacy and also cementing their own legacy. Has it always been this way, Dr. Michael Bitzer, or does the midterm in this case have some particular significance because of where we are in terms of our political lives?
Well, generally, midterms tend to be referendums on particularly the president's party. And in this case, we have unified party government. I mean, Republicans control the Congress, both the House and the Senate, and they control the White House, and they ostensibly can do whatever they want. Now, there's divisions within the Republican Party that makes governing even more difficult. And generally, what a party wants is a record to run on when they go before the voters, because the president's not going to be on the ballot. His party is going to be on the ballot through congressional candidates.
And what is the record to run on for Republicans? The tax plan?
They can claim the tax plan. They can certainly claim Neil Gorsuch. They can claim some other things. But there's not a whole lot there positively at this point that the Republicans point to and say, this is what we have to offer, put us back into power.
On the other hand, is there anything positive Democrats can say, or is it all going to be anti-Trump?
I think it's all anti-Trump at this point. It's going to be the referendum on the
but
president.
But don't they need some ideas of their own if they want to make inroads?
Yes, and they can kind of look to the Virginia and the Alabama U.S. Senate race and say, you know, if we run good candidates that have a message, they can certainly benefit from it. But, you know, the Virginia legislative races, I don't think anybody expected that kind of Democratic surge at that level to almost basically make the House of Delegates equal.
So Paul Shoemaker, history, as Michael just pointed out, tells us that the president's party generally loses seats in the midterm. That's happened in every midterm since the Civil War. How concerned are Republicans about that?
Well, I think they got to be concerned. There are a few exceptions to that, the 2002 election cycle and the 98 election cycle when Clinton was in his second term. The fact of the matter is that Republicans are where Republicans are today because of Barack Obama. The reference to the problems within the Republican Party and fights within the Republican Party or different divisions are true. Democrats have those same divisions. They're there, but they're not as prevalent right now because Trump is a unifying factor for Democrats. Barack Obama was a unifying factor for Republicans. So the 2010 election cycle, which was the first midterm for President Obama, Republicans made historic gains, not just in North Carolina, across the country. So Republicans have got to double down their efforts in the 2018 cycle. The good news is that there's a lot more tools that are available for candidates in that process. The one thing that needs to be brought into this discussion is North Carolina will be a blue moon election cycle in 2018. It happens every 12 years. There'll be no major race for United States Senate or no governor's race. That will have a dramatic impact on voter turnout.
Do you think that's right, even in the Trump era?
Oh, yeah. But I think this year it's going to be interesting because the research I've done midterms, generally registered Republicans have a higher turnout rate. Mm-hmm. This is going to test that theory. And I think when you go back to something like the midterm of 2006, registered Democrats and registered Republicans were equal in their turnout.
Well, there's something called the generic ballot. It's a poll question that asks voters whether they'll vote for Democrats or Republicans for Congress. And historically, it's been a good predictor of what will happen in the House races. In December, Democrats led by over 13 points, according to the 538 ballot tracker. A similar question on a CNN poll gave Democrats what they described as a staggering 18-point lead, 56% to 38%. What's your reaction to that, Dan?
Well, I was going to say the same thing, so we must have done our homework together last night. Yes, the generic
ballot. I did mine at 1 o'clock yesterday afternoon.
The generic ballot is very good for Democrats. And let's think about the leader of the Republican Party right now, which is Donald Trump. You have a very unpredictable, volatile human being that will attack anyone, anytime, that does not pledge loyalty to him. He never accepts blame or accountability. He doesn't stick his neck out for anyone. So with his approval ratings in the 30s, he's being propped up by the hard right base, which is very important in a Republican primary.
He stuck his neck out for Roy Moore.
And how did that go?
Well,
yeah,
Roy Moore was a flawed candidate.
A 25-year, the first time in 25 years he won an Alabama Senate seat. Same thing with Virginia, which was very historic. I can't see him except in very, very safe Republican districts, if there are such things in 2018. I can't see him out there campaigning like a lot of presidents do. I mean, like I said, Alabama, Virginia are great examples. I think his base is getting tired or getting confused. They're unenthusiastic. Just knowing Mecklenburg County and the state of North Carolina, we are recruiting candidates on the Democratic side like crazy. We're going to challenge every single seat federally and locally and on the state level this year.
So, Paul, as a Republican strategist, what's your reaction to what Dan just said, and what is your reaction to this so-called generic ballot question that has Democrats leading Republicans in terms of who voters want to send to Congress?
Well, first of all, from the candidate recruitment standpoint, Democrats, one of the things that advantage Democrats have going into this cycle here in North Carolina is Governor Cooper. They have basically been a rudderless ship for the last 8 years of the election cycles because of the problem. Cooper provides stability that's very important when it comes to how you put money together for races, for the national dollars and everything else. Republicans have got a lot of advantages on their side because they are the party in control. There will be a highly funded effort for both sides. One thing that comes into this factor is you look at voter turnout, you look at voter behavior. We can talk about intensities, we can talk about generic ballots. What comes down to the fact is who shows up, who participates, who gets into this ballgame. The 2006-8 cycle, which was 2006, which was referenced earlier, was another blue moon cycle. That was with George Bush, and that was an election that was an anti-Bush era into that, and you saw turnout about equal. The voter less likely to vote in this midterm cycle is going to be an unaffiliated voter. And to give you a little bit of statistics here, going back to the last two U.S. Senate races here in North Carolina, if you look at the 2010 turnout, we had 43.5% turnout. 2014, 44.02%. That was Tillis and Hagan. The difference between those two races is $100 million was spent. $100 million more was spent in 14 than 10, and voter turnout only increased less than 1 percentage point. Okay? So when you look at how these battles are going to be fought, they're going to be localized and they're going to be personalized. The Democrats are going to try to make this all about Trump. Republicans have got to localize their elections. They've got to personalize their elections. And both sides will bring new tools to the table, unlike what we have seen before in previous midterm cycles, just because of the technology changes that have taken place in the way campaigns are conducted throughout America.
So Democrats will certainly be pointing to President Trump in a negative way, and Republicans will have to decide how to handle their relationship with President Trump. And Mr. Trump has not had an easy time of getting things through Congress. But he says that bringing more Republicans to Washington is important.
We need more Republicans so that we can really get the rest of the Make America Great Again agenda passed.
So on average, the party of the president loses 32 seats in the House and 2 in the Senate during midterm elections. And this year's Democrats only need 24 seats. to flip the House and two to take the Senate. Is that doable, Michael, or is that just pie in the sky?
I think it's doable. And as Paul said, you know, the question is going to be who's going to show up. And we've already started talking about, you know, this mythical wave kind of an election. If the Democrats benefit from increased voter turnout, there could be some Republican seats, like, for example, here in North Carolina, that normally we would not be talking about going Democratic. That wave could carry them over and overcome the kind of built-in structural advantages that Republicans have based on what we talked about previously, redistricting.
So, Paul, the president just said we need more Republicans. Why? Why do Republicans need a greater majority than they already have, given the difficulty they've had in getting anything other than the tax plan passed? How would more Republicans help?
Well, a lot of that's referenced to the rules and the procedures of the U.S. Senate. And with even though you have a majority in the U.S. Senate, you've got to have 60 votes to get something passed. The House operates a little bit different from that. Let's get back a little bit about turnout real quick. Look at the Virginia numbers, and I run a lot of numbers all the time. Mm-hmm. Democrats, if you look at Northern's vote, I went back and compared what these candidates got compared to the presidential votes. He got 71% of the Clinton vote. Gillespie got 66% of the front vote. 5% intensity gap. You can apply that, and this is what makes what happened yesterday on congressional maps, and then I do agree that I think you will see this apply to legislative maps. This makes the redistricting drawing of the maps even become more critical. You currently apply that voter distribution to all these legislative maps. Republicans still fare pretty well. What's going to really impact is how these new, if we have new maps, how does those distributions start to play out?
And let's talk about these unaffiliated voters. We talked a lot about them going into the presidential contest, Michael. And we have the two parties as polar opposites playing to their bases, which are the extreme left and the extreme right. And everybody in the middle is kind of just left to drift, and they want something different, but they're not going to get it because of the way these districts are drawn and the way the primary system works, which favors the extremes of both parties. So what do Republicans say? What do Democrats say to these people in the middle, and particularly to unaffiliated voters, to bring them into the fold, at least for this one upcoming election?
Well, I'm going to quibble a little bit with this notion that these are pure independents out there.
There are really no independents, are
there? There's collectively, nationally, 10% of the electorate.
Right.
Is pure independent, meaning they could vote one way or the other. The remaining independents lean to one party over the other. And they may eschew or discount the party label, but they vote at levels that signal party loyalty. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these folks may not necessarily be the ones that show up, but if they get engaged, they are just as partisan as folks that identify with a political party.
So aside from Donald Trump, Dan, what do Democrats say to get their people enthusiastic enough to come out in this midterm election and to get unaffiliated voters or independents to side with them? Aside from using Donald Trump,
all right,
what do you say?
Donald Trump. No. Mueller. It's Mueller time. No, seriously.
It's Mueller time, yes.
Understand one thing, and let's talk about who the Republicans are now. These are not your father's Republicans anymore. This is not Ronald Reagan Republican base anymore. These are people that are extreme right. I mean, George Will, those folks, George Will cannot stand the current Republican Party. You know, William Buckley's turning in his grave. What happened to all those Republican stalwarts? They've been replaced by Donald Trump, Steve Bannon, Alex Jones, Rush Limbaugh. They, on a national level and also on a state level, they're doing nothing for the average working folks. They spend more time on social issues, building walls, creating boogeymen. As Democrats, we got to get back to the core. People deserve an opportunity to have health care. And not this game we're playing every couple of weeks with the Republicans in Washington trying to get rid of it. We need minimum wages set. We need infrastructure rebuilt. We need bread and butter. We need kitchen table issues right now. No more bedroom issues, which is what Republicans seem to thrive on. I mean, we got to get back to the basics of what the government is supposed to do for the people.
Should Democrats stop running away from the L word? liberal.
Liberal. Well, I mean, some of the liberal policies are things that Republicans don't realize they use every day, like Social Security, things of that nature. They're liberal policies.
Well, that's my
minimum
point.
Wage.
That's my point. But you guys run away from them.
I don't run from it. Of course, I'm not an elected official.
All right.
But no, we need to get back to who we are as Democrats and talk about all the good things we've done for this country since 1932.
So aside from Donald Trump, Paul, same question to you. What will drive Republicans to the polls and convince independents that to vote Republican candidates over Democrats, aside from using Donald Trump?
I think one thing we've got to take into account here is that we've got to look at the economic issues. And To Dan's point about difference of Republican Party, what's really taking place in this is the growth of the unaffiliates. The unaffiliates will participate in the general election process if they're brought out to do that. In fact, in the last 12 years of the 1.4 million new registered voters in North Carolina, a little over 1 million of those are unaffiliates, 75%. Those are people moving into the state. There's also former Republicans in that group. There's also former Democrats into that group. One risk that the Democrats have in this blue moon election cycle or the 2018 midterm is overplaying their hands. That's what happened in the 98 cycle against Clinton. Republicans overplayed their hands. He had a strong economy. He had put together a coalition that was a center-to-right coalition is what the president had. And so Republicans are going to have to play up on the economic of the current stock market keeps going to where it's going. If you look at the economic news, you look at your employment numbers, there's a lot of good news that's there, and it becomes a lot of the counter. Democrats are going to have more than just to hang the hat on than just not Trump.
But does the stock market really impact average middle class people all that much? They may have a couple of $1,000s in their 401k that's impacted by that, but mostly it's very rich people who are affected.
It's an economic mood indicator.
Okay.
Economic mood indicator.
Okay.
Always has been.
And those that don't want
to take that into account, particularly if they want to go back to the liberal world, I hope that the Democrats will embrace the liberal world.
Let's talk about 1999 when you guys were impeaching Bill Clinton, President Clinton. There was a 4% unemployment rate and a 4.7 GDP, and he created 3 million jobs that year. So I do want to say one more thing. You talk about liberals. Jim Hunt, 1999, 3% unemployment, probably the most robust North Carolina economy we ever had, and we had the reputation as being the most progressive city in the South with the best university college system. Those were the good old days to me.
And Dan, remember what I just said. Look at the 98 midterm cycle with Clinton in there, the Lewinsky scandals, everything else. Democrats did well. You elected John Edwards. That's my point.
The thing is, Trump overplays his hand every day.
And Bill Clinton had an approval rating at 66%, even though he was under impeachment in 98.
Trump is at 35% under investigation.
The word impeachment has now been spoken twice, and we want to talk about impeachment when we come back, because that seems to be a thing that really is exciting Democrats.
It's the bear in the room.
Yes, indeed. It's the bear. It's the bear in the room. We're going to talk about that. We'll talk about approval ratings. And I want to talk about structural issues within these parties, because they both have problems, structural problems in their party. And one of them kind of played out over the Christmas holiday here in North Carolina in the Robert Pittenger campaign. We'll talk about that when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and St. Mary's School in Raleigh, North Carolina, educating girls grades 9 through 12, welcoming prospective families for overnight and visitation day, January 15th and 16th, online at sms.edu. And the Employers Association, helping build successful employees through training and development, offering HR and computer classes and professional development. Details on upcoming classes at employersassociation.com. Across the country, students today headed to public schools that don't have enough teachers. Thousands of positions are vacant across the country, and guest host Ray Suarez will be talking about that with his guests, about what's driving the shortage, what will it take to get more people to enter the education field, and what's needed to keep teachers from leaving. That's all coming in 20 minutes during On Point here on WFAE, and we'll continue our conversation about politics in a moment.
Whether you're looking back at 2017 or looking ahead into the new year, big stories are everywhere.
The standard deduction nearly doubles.
Kim warned the U.S. that its mainland is within...
Allegations of sexual harassment and abuse.
So when you just need to get caught up or you want to dig deep, count on Morning Edition for the latest updates with all the background you need to put it into perspective. Listen every day.
From 5 until 9 on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Michael Bitzer, frequent host, but mostly he's a professor of political science at Catawba College. Dan McCorkle is a Democratic strategist. He's in our studio. Paul Shoemaker joins us by phone. He's a Republican strategist, and he works with, has worked with, Senator Richard Burr and also with Robert Pittenger, the 9th District Republican incumbent. Mr. Pittenger has a Republican challenger, Paul, Mark Harris. And the winner of the primary, obviously, will face a Democrat. But in over the holidays, Robert Pittenger ran a reasonably heavy schedule of television commercials talking about the importance of putting Christ back into Christmas. Does that show us that he's concerned about running against a former Baptist minister?
I'm assuming you're directing that question to me.
Yes, sir. I am, Paul.
All right. I mean, the reality is Republican primaries are primaries that are engaged on right-of-center issues and everything else. The holidays actually provide a very good opportunity to surprise a lot of other candidates that don't want to take the time to go up because, one, you're able to reach people. The media efficiencies are very good during that period of time, and it's more of a reflection of the fact that Congressman Pittenger is focused on taking any challenger very serious and will work very hard to...
But will people remember that when the primary rolls around? To spend all that money at Christmas time seem to be a little premature. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm not a political strategist.
Not necessarily. I mean, I can first of all, I mean, from a guy who makes his living doing political campaigns, everything else, you can never start too early. I can go all the way back to the... You look at the Kay Hagan, Tom Tillis... primary race, you actually had ads starring as Kay Hagan in 2013. We were up on the air from about February all the way through the rest of that year with the November election cycle. We were looking at a May primary date at that point in time. And actually having a higher presence, raising your profile as a candidate, it helps in a lot of other elements of putting together what you're doing in your ground game and as far as what you're doing on your fundraising programs and everything else. They all complement each other. It's just not one tactical operation of a campaign.
In the case of a lot of other operations. In the case of Robert Pittenger and Mark Harris, I think most people would agree, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, Michael, that these are both to the right side of the conservative movement in North Carolina and in the Congress. They would be both to the right of center, way to the right of center in some cases. And I'm told, I don't know this for a fact, but I'm told that we need to watch the Senate races this fall. Because we want to see how the anti-establishment versus establishment GOP candidates play out. That's the structural issue that I'm talking about, at least in the Republican Party.
Right.
There's this battle going on.
Yeah. I think the battle is very much evident. I mean, if you go back to the Republican primary in the U.S. Senate race in Alabama, it was very much establishment, Luther Strange versus both Mo – I'm trying to remember his last name. There was a congressman and then also the eventual Republican nominee. I think, you know, this both parties have different coalitions, but I think on the Republican side it is very aggravated between the Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan kind of an establishment coalition versus the insurgency that Trump certainly represents, but that others represent as well. And in the 9th district, you know, just in 2016, Mark Harris lost to Robert Pittenger by 134 votes. And so I think this rematch will be certainly one to watch with national implications.
And there are big money interests on both sides of this equation. The Democrats have George Soros and other people. The Koch brothers are often mentioned when it comes to Republicans with regard to, on both sides, to their support monetarily to individual candidates and to PACs. But on the Democratic side, at least one wealthy person is not only putting his money forward, he's putting his face forward. He's appearing on lots of TV ads advocating the impeachment of the president. I'm talking about Tom Steyer. He's spending $30 million of his own money to help Democrats retake the House and more. And here is how he sees the midterms.
2018 is going to be a straightforward debate between two radically different visions of America. My fight is in removing Donald Trump from office and from power. And that starts with taking the House back.
How effective can Tom Steyer be with these messages, Michael?
Well, I think certainly he's working to get the message out and to energize and mobilize a Democratic base that is very energized to begin with, and they need to show up, as Paul mentioned and others have mentioned, that you know it's all about who shows up in November. The question is, latching on to the impeachment process, yes, this is a political dynamic. And the fact that if you get a majority in the House, you can certainly impeach anybody. The problem is going into the Senate with the supermajority required, it's like in the Bill Clinton situation, not going to go anywhere because Democrats aren't going to be able to have those kinds of numbers.
And people have to understand that the word impeachment doesn't mean if you're impeached, you're out.
Correct.
That's just a process.
You're charged.
You are
charged and then tried in the U.S. Senate.
Right.
And if the Senate votes to convict with a supermajority, then the person is removed. But this is, as we saw in the Clinton impeachment, it's not going anywhere. It's a political dynamic.
So there's all this talk on the Democratic side, particularly on MSNBC. They're practically, and I'm going to have
ratings are soaring.
I'm going to have to say this. They're practically wetting their pants every night on MSNBC over this. I mean, it's almost to the point of ludicrousness. But do you think, Dan, as a Democrat, that that's productive, that as you head into the midterms to focus on the removal of Donald Trump from office? Is that productive?
Well, first, Democrats are so charged up, it's unreal. And remember who the emerging Democratic Party is. It's younger than before. It's more progressive. It's extremely female. I mean, we're running so many female candidates this year, it's unreal. They are taking back the party. They're also going to take back the country. The guy you were talking about earlier, he's the one that bought a copy of Fire and Fury for every single member of Congress in the last couple of days.
What, Tom Steyer?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Bought a copy for all of them so they can read. They don't have to go on Amazon and get their own copy. It's been provided for them. That book will actually further erode, in my opinion, the unaffiliated support for Trump. The folks that voted for Trump because they didn't like Hillary, they voted for Trump because, say, they did not they figured he would be a businessman. Well, he's not running the country anything like a businessman. If this is the way he runs his business, God help his businesses.
But are Democratic candidates well served by simply focusing on what you perceive to be the negatives of Donald Trump and the fact that you'd like him booted out of office prematurely? Or would you be better served by talking about what you want to do for people?
It's giving us that boost to get up out of your chair and do something. It's not going to be the thing that wins the election for us, the issues I talked about, bread and butter issues, but it's getting Democrats excited, motivated, enthusiastic to get this thing done. Let's win this thing. And hey, if Mueller finds something out and he's out of office, so be it.
Michael, what's your take on that?
On the impeachment process?
On Democrats focusing on impeachment of a president as opposed to what I can do for you, voter.
I think certainly they have to put forward an agenda because if they win majority control in a year when they take over the Congress, if they take over the Congress, they're going to have to put something out for not just for themselves, but also leading into the 2020 election. So they've got to have some kind of an agenda, but it is certainly the energy is anti-Trump at this point.
As a political scientist, does it not bother you that we've been through this so many times in recent history? There have been impeachment processes. Well, there was an impeachment of President Clinton. People wanted to impeach George W. Bush. Mm-hmm. They talked about, rumored about, doing something like that with Obama. Mm-hmm. Every president, we can't impeach every president just because they're from the other party, can we?
Why not? We're in this hyper-polarized environment.
We didn't used to do that. Does it make you worry about whether or not the country is governable?
I'm beyond worried, to be quite frank. I don't see how we get ourselves out of this situation in which we are not willing to have any compromise, any sort of willingness to do something that isn't going to sting or attack or denigrate the other side. We've been at this for some time, and the situation is at a low point. Certainly, we can look in past history and say we've survived these kinds of things. But at this point in time, I talk to fellow political scientists, historians, we're kind of disheartened.
So, Paul, Dan has already referenced Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury book, which came out, I think, this week and has cast aspersions on President Trump's competence and his mental stability and the fact that everybody in the White House, according to Mr. Wolff, thinks he's a moron and dangerous, and they're doing everything they can to keep the train on the track. Will all this be forgotten by November?
No, because there's going to be a lot of money spent by a lot of Democrats trying to remind everybody. From now all the way through November. What we have here, and I want to pick up a little bit, and Dr. Bitzer talks about the polarization. One of the things that we need to realize is that the voting public is polarized as well. Democrats are polarized from registered. Those who identify themselves still as Republicans and still identify themselves as Democrats, they are polarized. You have the unaffiliated that are there in the middle. They're less polarized. They're the most frustrated voters that are out there. I do a lot of survey research. Lawmakers, we can talk about polarization within Congress, polarization within state legislature. Well, the reality is it exists in the voting public as well. You can go out and ask questions, people's opinions on a set of questions, and they can have 75-80% agree. You can go right back and ask the same questions and say, this is Hillary Clinton's position or this is Donald Trump's position or whatever else. The polarization then comes into play. That's the setup of the American political process. It's also a process that's been guaranteed to us by our Constitution and freedom of political speech. We're just in a new era of communications, a new era of mass media, a new era of polarization with even our media, our listeners to radio programs like this versus MSNBC versus Fox News. We live in a polarized society. What's going to drive these midterms is going to be, first of all, what messages do both sides hang their hat on? Democrats are going to try to hang it on Trump because it provides them energy. If they overplay that, they will actually create energy on the Republican side. That's the risk of the impeachment process.
So let's
there are better tools. There's better tools today to go after these unaffiliates on both sides. That means you're going to have an issue set. Both sides are going to have a new issue set. It becomes a more competitive process, which at the end may be good for the process. Mm-hmm.
So let's bring it home to North Carolina. National pundits often refer to this state as a purple state, but former Representative Sue Myrick has said she doesn't believe that. She says North Carolina is red and getting redder. Is she right, Michael?
I don't know what evidence she would point to. That is something, as a political scientist, I tend to operate in numbers and facts. If you look at the Hagen-Tillis race, I believe it was within 2 points of a margin of victory. Certainly the presidential election was within 3 points in this state. It is a divided state. I think the inherent advantages of redistricting helps Republicans and perhaps skews the numbers
at the moment.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, this state is, as Paul said, and I think as Dan has said, there's a tectonic shift occurring in this state: urbanization and the generational cohort that is coming of age. And I think that's going to pose some real interesting dynamics moving forward.
So as of last summer, I understand the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee has targeted 3 North Carolina seats, those held right now by George Holding in the 2nd District, Robert Pittenger in the 9th, Ted Budd in the 13th, in their attempts to flip control of the House. Have you identified candidates to run as a Democrat in those districts, Dan McCormick?
Absolutely, we have.
What is the strategy?
Well, we have 2 strong candidates in the 13th as it is drawn right now. We have a couple of strong candidates in the 9th. I'm not familiar with the other district enough to make a decision. But as far as Democrats, I want to say one thing.
Now, what's the strategy?
The strategy is to talk about jobs, environment, education, and infrastructure, and stop talking about Amendment 1, HB2, and all those things that divide us, hyper-divide us. Those were totally unnecessary amendments that really divided the state and created an even bigger urban-rural split.
And unlike 2016, this will be a state-by-state decision. There won't be any president on the ballot, and those decisions will be reflected not only in Congress but in state legislators. North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper is optimistic about what will happen in legislative elections.
We've stood up and, you know, we've gone to court when we've had to, and I think that mix in the legislature is going to change after the elections this year. Mm-hmm. I think you're going to see a much more balanced legislature, which is something I think that the people want to see.
Even if he's right about the people wanting to see this, and I'm not saying he is right. I'm just saying if he were right, have districts been drawn in such a way that to make that next to impossible?
I think the balance for Democrats is breaking the supermajority veto numbers. If they can get that and be able to sustain a Cooper veto in either chamber, mm-hmm. I think they will consider that a win.
How many legislative seats are up in North
Carolina? All of them.
All of them. Okay, we have to talk about the other person in the room, Oprah Winfrey. After Oprah's speech at the Golden Globes on Sunday night, one that was not intended to be political, she ignited a Twitter storm about running for president in 2020. Not her idea. She's always poo-pooed the idea, but now her friend, Gayle King, host of CBS This Morning, says Oprah is taking the idea seriously. Even though she's certainly as qualified as President Trump for the job, would it be wise for Democrats to field her as a candidate should she choose to get into the race, Dan?
Well, that is totally her choice, but I think behind the scenes she could do wonders for us raising money and getting our issues out there for future President Biden.
Would it be a good would it be a good thing or a bad thing to have another celebrity, not that politicians aren't celebrities,
right,
but run for office?
Why not? I mean, it seems to be the new norm.
Donald Trump, who once said he chose Oprah as his running mate, now says he'd beat her. Paul, would he?
I think that's a long ways off for that. I think what you got to look at is understand Trump came to the presidency as a personality because of the brand. Oprah definitely brings a brand, brings a personality to the table from that standpoint. The real question is going to be, what's going to be the issue set facing the American public and American voter when you get into the 2020 presidential cycle?
Paul Shoemaker is a Republican strategist in North Carolina. Dan McCorkle, a Democratic strategist. Dr. Michael Bitzer is professor of political science at Catawba College. Always a pleasure. Thank you all for the hour.